was deluded by John Lewis's love. Hello and welcome. You are tuned into another episode of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on the program each and every week, I find and feature themes relating to Appalachian culture and folklore, and then play songs and feature tales and stories all about our selected topic of choice. I also love to feature special guests, including local and regional artisans, storytellers and musicians, and those just doing really interesting things here in the region. On today's program, I'll be talking with Doug Van Gundy. Doug is a poet and musician who is currently an associate professor of creative writing at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Today, we talk about music, poetry, and Appalachia, and I do hope you join us this hour here on Mountain Song and Story. I've got a really great program ahead. We'll be getting into that interview with Doug Van Gundy here in just a few minutes, but first, some music.
Far away strand is a beautiful home of the soul. Built by Jesus on high, there we never shall die, is a land where we'll never grow old. Never grow old,
where we'll never grow old,
in the land where we'll never grow old. Never grow old. Beautiful home, where we'll never more roam, we shall be in the sweet by and by. Happy praise to the King, through eternity sing, is a land where we never shall die. Never grow old,
we'll never grow
old, in the land where we'll never grow old. Life crown is won, and our troubles and trials are o'er. All our sorrow will end, and our voices will blend with the loved one who've gone on before. Never grow old,
we'll never grow old,
in the land where we'll never grow old.
Never grow old,
all right. right. So joining me now is poet and musician Doug Van Gundy. Doug is from Elkins, West Virginia, and I'm so excited to be talking with you today. We've been trying to work this out for a long time after meeting at Augusta to actually have a chance to sit down and talk. Welcome. It's great to have you on.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm glad we finally got it together, too. Thanks, Tony.
Yeah, so we have a lot of things that I'd really like to talk with Doug about today. Not only are you a poet, but you're also a musician. And we have this shared love of Carter Family music, which is very fitting for Radio Bristol and, of course, for the birthplace of country music, where we're broadcasting out of. So let's start by you telling me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from in West Virginia? I know you grew up in Elkins. And how did you kind of find how did you find your voice in music and get started with poetry, you know, this really creative field?
Well, they're two very different stories. I mean, I grew up surrounded by music. And so I am from Elkins, West Virginia. And the Augusta Heritage Workshops started in the summer of 1970. I think it was 74. It may have been even earlier than that, but I was a kid, and we were on the campus of Davis and Elkins College. That's where it was hosted it still is. And my father taught biology and environmental science at Davis and Elkins. So I was on the campus all the time. So from the time I was 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old, there was this summer event, the Augusta Heritage Workshops. And so there were musicians from all over, traditional musicians, both old and young, and then just through the year, Elkins has always had a square dance, and so there was lots of traditional music and older people around. I grew up around Woody Simmons, who was a wonderful fiddler from up in Mill Creek, Becky's Creek, West Virginia, and then years later, I mean, I loved it when I was a kid, and then as so often happens, the thing that you're that's familiar becomes the thing you're embarrassed by. And I ended up sort of turning my face to traditional music and country music and playing in a hardcore punk band in the 80s when I was just a garage band. We never really played anywhere, but was really into the punk scene. I went to the University of Utah from Elkins to Salt Lake City, and then was active in the punk scene there, and then came back east and met and married my wife. And I always played guitar in a punk band. And I had, when I was in Utah, I'd started to get into listening to bluegrass and old time music again. And Norman Blake was my great hero, and still is one of my great heroes. So I had sold all my electric gear and bought an old Martin and was trying to learn to flat pick a little bit. And came back to West Virginia. And the first Christmas that my wife and I were married, her grandmother said, "I know that you like music. I've got something for you." And she said, "It's under the bed you're staying in." We're visiting her at Christmas time. And so I went, looked under the bed, and there was a fiddle case. And it turns out that my wife's grandmother was the second violin in the Ohio All-State Youth Orchestra.
Oh, wow. And, that's a title.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was like the young woman who beat her out for her first chair went to Juilliard. And the woman she made out for second chair went to Ohio State and studied music, was a music teacher. And she just put the fiddle under the bed and didn't play really after she got married and had kids. And so she gave me her violin, as she called it. And I just thought, well, I should learn something to thank her. And that's when I was living down in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, around Marlinton, and I met Dwight Diller, who was one of my neighbors, and Dwight's a legendary Klahoma banjo player, and he hooked me up with a bunch of field recordings of the Hammonds family, who Dwight recorded and was part of how the Hammonds family got recorded for the Library of Congress. And so I started to get into the music the oldest music of East Central West Virginia. And then I, through Dwight, his tapes, I found out that there was a fiddler that I really liked, a guy by the name of Mose Coffin, that Dwight had recorded. And I found that he was still alive. He was living in a nursing home. And so he was 88 and I was 28. And we started working together. And he taught me to really play. Dwight got me exposed to the music and gave me a literacy in it. And then Mose, who was born in 1905, he taught me to play. So that's how I got into the fiddle. And then with the poetry, it was sort of the opposite. I was always interested in language. I was always interested in the words and the stories and what words could do to us, whether in song lyrics or stories or poems. But all the poets that I knew were from England and were dead. And I didn't know any living writers, really, until I went off to college. And then that's where I got exposed to poets like James Wright and Charles Wright. No relation, but Charles, of course, is from was the Library of Congress, the poet laureate of the United States, and he's from Pickwick Dam, Tennessee, which is just over near Kingsport. And here were these two poets that I discovered in college in Utah, and one was from Tennessee, and the other was from Appalachian, Ohio, right across the river from Wheeling, and they're both writing about people in the mountains and life in the country, and I didn't know that you could write about the place that I was from and have it be art. So that really opened my eyes, and then I got really fell off the deep end for poetry.
Yeah, you know, your story sounds a lot like so many people here in Appalachia, just being young and leaving and then coming back and finding this really newfound appreciation for where you're from and kind of a lifelong passion for writing and playing music and really featuring where you're from on a creative field. And I think it's really interesting, Doug, that you were 28 whenever you learned how to play the fiddle, if I'm understanding that correctly, right?
That's right. When I started, I was 28 years old.
Did you find that really challenging? Because I myself am 28 years old, and I've tried to play the fiddle many times, and it's a very difficult instrument.
Well, I there was a woman by the name of Phoebe Parsons, who's a banjo player from Braxton in Calhoun County, West Virginia. And I got to know her a little bit toward the end of her life. And I was around her one time. Someone asked her how she got started playing. And she said, "I learned some of it and I kept playing it." And I thought, yeah, that's how you do it. And that's what I did. I learned some of it. And I was lucky enough that we were living at the head of a holler, last house on the road. And when I first started playing, and I would go out to the yard and play. And I started playing in March. And I'd go out in the yard and practice so my wife didn't have to hear it. And she said to me one time, she said, "If our marriage can survive you learning to play the fiddle, it can survive anything." So, yeah, you've got to be prepared to just make the worst sounds you've ever heard. You've got to be prepared to go through that and just tolerate it. Wilson Douglas, the great, great Clay County fiddler, told me one time, he said, "You have to make 10,000 mistakes learning to play the fiddle. You might as well make them all up front."
Yeah. That's very you're motivating me right now, because I've tried and I haven't gotten very far. But
once you start to make sounds that you recognize, and more importantly that other people recognize, it's the most rewarding instrument, because it doesn't come easy. When you can start to get something out of a fiddle, it's like alchemy. It's just amazing that you can take this wood and wire and horsehair and pine rosin and turn it into music. It's just, it's magic.
Yes, it definitely is. So let's talk about poetry for a little bit. Your first book of poems is called A Life Above Water. It was published back in 2007 by Red Hen Press. Tell us a little bit about this collection and putting it together. And if you wouldn't mind reading a few poems, that would be fantastic.
Sure. The collection, a handful of the poems were started when I was getting my Master of Fine Arts degree in graduate school. And I went to grad school in Vermont, in low residency program up there. And it's funny, it was in a small town in Vermont, at Goddard College, but very few people had any kind of a rural or country upbringing in the program. Most of them were from New York or Boston. And then actually they're from all over the country. It's a low residency program. So you only had to be there in person, you know, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks a year. But most of the people were urban people and which is, you know, absolutely a valid experience, but there was nobody that really had my background, and I kind of had to struggle to figure out that it was okay for me to write what I wanted to write. And I think that experience actually forced me to discover the voice that I have, because I had to sort of fight to be myself. But the book, some of those poems started there, and then I just kept writing. I've always written a lot. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I've literally got hundreds of poems that are unpublished, like 500 poems that are unpublished.
Oh, wow.
That are just laying around, and I need to put together another book. That's one of my projects for the coming year, is to get that second book out somewhere. But the title comes from a line in one of the poems. It's written from the point of view of a trout. And my dad's a biologist. And so I spent a lot of time, he was an aquatic biologist for starts. And we spent a lot of time around rivers. And while he was looking for aquatic insects, and I grew up doing a lot of fishing, grew up real near the Tagatelli River and did a lot of fishing and there as a kid. And so I've always been attracted to fishing and water. And so that poem, the title came from that, where this trout sort of imagines what it's like to live above the water, as I so often, the inverse of what I imagined all the time when I was a kid, which is, boy, it'd be great if you could breathe underwater.
Yeah.
So I just inverted that.
Yeah.
But if you want a poem or two, I'll tell you, I'll start one that's I'll start with one that's I think appropriate to where you are. This is a poem that appeared. It's not in the book. It came out after that. I wrote it after that, but it appeared in the Oxford American magazine, out of Oxford, Mississippi. Well, originally out of Oxford, Mississippi. I guess they're over in Arkansas now. But it's called Country Music. And I grew up with my granddad. Country music was the music of my grandfather. And, you know, that's how I first heard Carter Family songs, was through him. But he also really loved, like, Hank Snow and Kitty Wells and Eddie Arnold, that sort of 50s country music.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I grew up around that Patsy Cline. You love Patsy. This is a poem called Country Music. It's a high trebly sound all piled up on the heart until it's spilling out through the nose of an AM radio. That sweet anguish of knowing you're not crazy for feeling so blue. That while nothing is ever going to salve the wound in your heart, at least there is someone who's been down this way before and had the wisdom and foresight to bring along a guitar. Late in the night, when the ache it's as bad as it gets, and the moon is as pale and as gold as a draft beer. The atmosphere takes on the hard sheen of polished wood on a VFW dance hall floor, and the signal skips all the way across the sky, from WSM Nashville to the blue hollows of the Green Alleghenies, pushed hard by fiddles and guitars and 50,000 crackling watts. Here, brothers and fathers, sisters and mothers, cousins and next-door neighbors gather around the lighted dial of the vacuum tube oracle, or sit alone on the bench seats of idling pickup trucks to learn just how their cheating hearts will tell on them, or to be coaxed into going honky-tonking, or simply lulled into sweet dreams by the whiskied honey of voices that got just far enough away from these mountains to get flung back home.
Oh man, that is fantastic. That is so fitting for Bristol. You're totally correct on that. Yes. I know our listeners will love that. You know, and speaking of classic country music and the Carter family, I know you perform a lot of Carter family songs as well. When it's a normal year and we're actually performing, why do you feel like it's important to keep those songs in history alive? I know one thing that I just love about the Carter family catalog, and whenever I started getting into it personally, is just how relevant the songs can still be today. I mean, just yesterday I had a Carter family CD in my car, and it was, I don't remember the song right off the top of my head, but the point of the song was, I'm longing for the old home place, basically, and it's nothing like it used to be, was like the theme in the song. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, that is still so relevant, and I can connect to that music still so much, even though this was recorded in the 1930s, you know. And so how do you feel your connection to music like the Carter family is? How do you tie that into your performances?
Well, like you said, there's something so deeply human and so universal about that music. It really touches on the human experience and gives us access to the human heart in a way that we don't maybe necessarily allow our hearts to be accessed. I think we're all maybe a little protective, a little self-protective, maybe a little defensive, and something about that music just cuts right to the center of things. And when I first heard the Carters, I felt seen, you know. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a song. I don't know if this is the one you're talking about. Is it Little Log Cabin in the Lane?
I'm thinking of isn't that one, but it's oh man, I was singing it all day yesterday. But yeah, it's a very similar to that. I'm thinking of maybe Old and Faded Picture on the Wall, maybe something like that. But there's so many that have that similar theme, you know?
Sure. And one of my favorites, which you don't really hear all that often, I think, is Will You Miss Me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is just such a great song of long, of, you know, there's so many songs that are about longing, but the person who's leaving doesn't often have the voice like they do in that song. You know, will you miss me when I'm gone? It's not you're gone and I miss you. It's will you miss me if I'm gone? And, you know, think of the night of my blue eyes. I don't know. This song's just all, they're so relatable. I don't, you know, I think that the circumstances of our existence have changed a lot, but I think that human beings are still pretty much the same as they've been for a very long time. And I think our deepest concerns are still the same, you know, love and safety and home. But when I was living out in Salt Lake City, that's when I really started listening to the Carters, because it made me so homesick. And somehow when you're homesick, there's nothing better than listening to something that makes you more homesick.
Right. It's funny how that works. Yeah.
So the Carters, I just felt like, you know, all of those songs about longing and about home and, you know, I don't know, family, and it really helped me to feel tied to the place that I couldn't physically be. And then when we started, when I got together with Paul Gertner, when we formed Born Old, we, from the beginning, we were playing Carter songs because we both loved them so much. And then we just have kept doing it. And so we, like when we play, we almost always play like Waves on the Sea. And we do, the Golden Vanity. One of the things that I think is really important about the Carters, and this doesn't get touched on, maybe it does where you are, but I don't think it gets touched on in the public, in the sort of public perception of them as much, is that AP was a terrific folklorist. And so many of those songs that we think of as him having written, he actually gathered, he collected them. And he'd go to tent revivals and fairs and song singings, and he would write down the lyrics, and so many of those are sort of like floating verses from old, you know, songs from the British Isles or old Appalachian songs that they took and incorporated into what they were doing as well. So I think in that regard, the Carters helped preserve a lot of music from an earlier time by incorporating into what they were doing and singing those old songs as well as originals.
Yeah, absolutely. We had an exhibit here a few years ago at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum called Cecil Sharp, and it was about song catching. Yeah, and it was it touched a little bit on AP Carter. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, we had a small part about that. And his work with just doing just what you just said. And even a song like Wildwood Flower, the origins are still not known because it's so old, you know. And a lot of those songs are really interesting when you start diving into where did they actually come from. And, you know, this is one group that popularized them, but the origins are just so old that it comes from an oral tradition. So, it's amazing that they're still alive and people still sing them and perform them, and groups like yourself keep them alive for newer audiences. And I think that's what's really magical and great about it.
I started digging around. You mentioned Wildwood Flower, which I think is, for a lot of people, their first introduction to the Carters. And it was for me. I just, every person who played the guitar in West Virginia that I ever met could play Wildwood Flower. It was like the first song that everybody learned. And it was like the Stairway to Heaven of its day, I guess.
Yeah.
And
that's a great way to put that. Yeah.
Play that. but I remember, you know, knowing the Carter lyrics and then doing some research, trying to find some other verses and whatnot, and realized that so many of the things in the Carter version, where I believe it's Sarah is singing the lead on that, and they're things that she heard, but they got twisted a little bit. Like, I will twine, I will mingle, my rhythm black hair. And she says, and with the roses so red and eyes look like blue. But if you go back to the older version, it's this list of flowers, right? With the roses so red and ice look so blue. Mm-hmm. And so just these things that get twisted, you know, that oral tradition, that folk process where things get twisted around. I was just going to say, it's funny that, you know, Cecil Sharp is so important, but, you know, he was born in London, died in London. There's still, to this day, in London, there's a Cecil Sharp house that you can go. They have concerts and they have you know, resources for people who are interested in folk music and the English Folk Dance and Song Society in London still runs the Cecil Sharp House, and they have concerts and things like that. It's pretty cool. But it's funny what an influence he was as this guy who was born in the 1850s in London. Sometimes it takes somebody from somewhere else to show you what's special about the thing that you have. You know?
Yeah.
Thank you. been hanging out of town in that low-down rain, watching Good Time Charlie friends driving me insane. Down on shady Charlotte Street, the green lights look red. Wish I was back home on the farm in my feather bed. Get myself a rocking chair to see if I could lose them thin dime, hard time, the hell on Church Street blues. Found myself yesterday's news, folded up page 21, stuck it in my shoes. Gave me nickel to the poor, my good turn for today. Folded up my old billfold and threw it far away. And I got myself a rocking chair to see if I could lose them thin dime, hard time, my hell on Church Street blues. Black Diamond brand, I'd string up this old Martin box and go and join some band. But I guess I'm gonna stay right here, just pick and sing a while. Try to make me a little change and give them folks a smile. And give myself a rocking chair to see if I can lose them thin dime, hard time, my hell on Church Street blues. Give myself a rocking chair to see if I can lose.
Church Street Blues there from Norman Blake. And if you've been tuning in here, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. Today I am talking with poet and musician Doug Van Gundy. We are talking all about Appalachia music, poetry, and more. And we're going to go ahead and get into the second half of that interview here on the show today. Talking about making a positive impact in Appalachia, why do you feel... So this region, obviously, and it's such a hot topic, we face a lot of stereotypes and challenges here on a global scale. And how do you feel work in the creative field, such as poetry and music, what you do, is making a difference in Appalachia, making us seem, putting us more in a positive light to the outside world? How do you feel, how do you handle the kind of the pressures from any outsiders that are coming in here? What would you kind of tell them to say, hey, look, this is a really amazing place that has so much rich and beautiful culture and music and creativity here. Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
It's funny. Many people have said to me over the years, folks from Appalachia said, you know, it's so nice that your work, your poems, your show Appalachia in a positive light. And I really don't try to do that. I try to show it honestly, which I think is the truest form of respect, is to accept a place or a person or whatever as itself on its own merits. And so, yeah, we do have a lot of problems, and a lot of those stereotypes bite so hard because there's an element of truth. You know, there is poverty, there is joblessness, there's desperation, there's the opioid crisis. All of those things are real, but that's only one story. That's only one part of the picture, and there's so much more. And that's what I normally say to people from outside who say, oh, I read Hillbilly Elegy or whatever. It's just, I say, well, that's one story. Mm-hmm. And the problem with using Hillbilly Elegy as an example is that I think Vance takes that and says, he pushes beyond this is my story to this is the story of the region. and that's dangerous because you say that this one story, it becomes this emblematic single story of the region, and then that's how people see us, and that's not, it's not that it's not true, it's just grossly incomplete. And there is a great deal of there's a great deal of value in our traditions, and there's a great deal of innovation that's going on. And you know, we're not stuck like a bug in amber. The region moves and breathes and changes. And what I've always tried to do is sort of keep one eye on our traditions and try to keep those alive because I think they're valuable. Partially because they're our history, but partially because there's just so much pleasure to be gained from them, from our music and from our material culture and the folk culture, our food ways. There's just so much pleasure, such a celebration of the human spirit. And so I think that that's an important reason to keep our traditions going as any. And it's easy to maybe try to be more noble than we actually are. And I don't mean that negatively. I just mean that you say, well, I want to keep this going because it's our history and it's our past. Yeah, but it's also fun, and there's so much pleasure to be taken from it. And I think that's a completely worthy reason as well. This the joy that can come from sharing food or sharing a recipe or singing songs together, or making music together, or looking at someone's woodworking or handiwork, quilting, whatever. I think that it's important to sort of see ourselves as we are and as we were and how we want to be. And there's, you know, that single story doesn't incorporate, you know, all of the stories of the people of color who've been in the mountains forever. You know, I always like to point out that the banjo is a West African instrument, and the style, the mountain style of banjo, that claw hammer, is the way that people play that instrument in West Africa, that downstroke with the thumb. That's a very African way of playing a very African instrument, and so that's a more complex way of looking at music. But there's Northern European melodic traditions and singing traditions combined with African rhythms and African instruments. I really like to honor the complexity of the place and just try to show things as I expect. I do tend to, I think, sometimes fall back on some of the old tropes, but only because they still have power and they still have resonance.
Yeah, I really like what you say about the honesty. That really resonates. I think that's a very important takeaway. I really, really like that.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll share a poem that I think is kind of tries to do that, tries to see things as they are and acknowledge those things. So, West Virginia has frequently suffered from really bad flooding. And for people outside the region, it's hard for them to understand, but if you're in the mountains, how can it flood? Doesn't the water just run out? Yeah, but you know, these flash floods. And so Southern West Virginia had a bunch of, I lived through the 1996 floods in Marlins when I was living there, and I had about 7 feet of water in downtown. The 2006 flood. No, sorry, the 1996 flood. The 1985 flood was a big flood up in Central West Virginia. 1996 was a big flood in Central and East Central West Virginia. And then just the past couple of years, just been bad flooding in Southern West Virginia. So one of the things that really struck me about living through that flood in Marlington is how strange and beautiful the city, the town was while it was flooded. So this is a poem that tries to acknowledge that, which is, know, it's a hard thing to say when people have lost their houses and lost their livelihoods, and to say, yeah, wasn't it kind of pretty? So try to get both of those things in here. So this is called A Flooded Town. So admit for a moment what is to come. The reek of diesel, the swollen drywall crumbling back to dust, the liberated spores of mold in full black bloom. And just notice this, an empty town at the exact moment the waters crest, nearly silent and everything still. Places that were backyards and ravines and parking lots and will be again are, for the moment, backwaters where ducks and wading birds survey their new brief territory. A heron perches on a state road sign. A pair of mallards huddle atop the last dry step of the Baptist church. Savor the silence. The clouds are breaking up and sunlight is spilling through. This is not the optimistic ending, the silver sentimental lining. No one will be spared their share of sorrow, their little ladle full of loss. Misery has a long beach. But for now, one might be forgiven for seeing them as beautiful, these sunken, unpeopled streets.
Wow, yeah. That is beautiful. Your poetry, it really resonates, and it's very, I'm at a loss for words, Doug. I'm at a loss for words.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Do you have any other projects that you're currently working on as far as poetry goes? I know that the book Life Above Water came out a few years ago. I'm sure you have other books. I know you mentioned that you had over 500 notebooks full of poetry that was unpublished. What about some of the other things you have published?
500 single poems, not 500 notebooks. 500
okay. Single poems. It's still impressive.
It's a few. So I'm working on two manuscripts. One is a really sort of unabashedly Appalachian collection, which I never thought I would write, but I never thought I'd do. But in fact, I have plenty of poems to fit that. So this is there's one that's going to be a very West Virginia, very Appalachian collection, and then one is a little more sort of contemporary poetry that doesn't particularly have to do with place or region. And then I kind of about 100 poems, actually exactly 100 poems, with another poet. We invented this form that is a conversational form. And so each of us wrote half of each poem. And it has this pretty strict back and forth, but it's a novel in verse that is the story of these sort of dysfunctional brothers who come back together and sort of find a way to be close and to be affectionate to one another, but they're very dysfunctional. It's full of all sorts of bad behavior, and it's kind of fun. So we're shopping that around right now. And then last summer, 19. Yeah, I did a project with a photographer from Charlottesville, Virginia, a guy by the name of Matt Eich. And he and I did a project together where we spent 2 weeks, one in July and one in December, in Webster County, West Virginia. And Webster County is one of the most isolated counties in the state and one of the smallest populations and one of the lowest per capita incomes. And we wanted to, like you said, we wanted to show that the place wasn't just that one story. It wasn't the just retirees, just politically conservative, just white. And so we've spent a lot of time talking to people. Started out just going to diners and talking to people over lunch and dinner, and because that's where communities, especially in small communities, that's where people come together, you know? And then we got all kinds of leads from the diners. Oh, you should go by the library. They've got this photo collection, and you should go by the courthouse and talk to so-and-so. You should go to this place, not that. And so we spent all this time, and then we ended up, I wrote a dozen or 15 poems, and Matt took hundreds of pictures. And so he was responding to the experience of being there and these stories in his way, and I was responding in my way. And then he and I were having conversations, sort of debriefing about the trip, and that informed which photographs he chose, and while we were there, which photographs he took, and his insights and his photographs and informed my poems. And those were then published in the Guardian newspaper in England, and then, of course, on the web, on their website. It's still available on the website. And that was really kind of wonderful to have this sort of global audience for his photographs and my poems. And to show Appalachia in a way that might not be 100% what people expect.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. You'll have to send me a link to that, and I can share it on our blog page so people can check that out and have a visual for that. I would love to see that.
I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah. And where can folks go to learn a little bit more about what you're doing? Do you have a website someone could check out?
I have a website, but it's not really together. That's not something that it's something I need to be better at. It's self-promotion. But if you Google my name, there's a bunch of poems out there. I've published a few at with Still, the journal, STILL. And that's out of Berea College. And it's a wonderful online journal, arts journal. So I published a number of poems there. And then also I did some photographs for them. I was their featured visual artist 1 month. You can find some poems and photographs there. If you just Google my name, you can find some other things online. You can find that, the Guardian project. And you know, Matt and I continue to work on that. We had a poem and a photograph in a show about contemporary Appalachia in Berlin, Germany. And we had another one in a show in Chicago at the Catherine Edelman Gallery. And then there's a show that's going in at West Virginia University, looking at the legacy of Walker Evans and his Appalachian photographs, and says contemporary photographers responding to that. And Matt and I are going to do a lecture discussion around our project as part of that for WVU. So if you Google that, that will be an online thing, because it's going to happen before this pandemic is all over. So it'll be online, and if you're interested, you can check it out from there. And then my day job is that I direct the low residency Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Mm-hmm. And we've got a series of readings that will be live during our winter residency, January. I guess that'll be after this airs. So, but they'll be archived. We have a number of readings archived by writers from all over, including from the region. And that's on our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/ WVWCMFA.
All right, yeah.
So you can access fiction and nonfiction and poetry from the region and beyond. And you can look at some of the readings and hear some of the readings.
Yeah, and we'll have...
If you're interested in more...
Yeah, we can put some links to our website too after the program airs, so people can check that out. Our listeners can definitely get some visuals and learn more about what you're doing and all of the great projects that you just talked about. And we are winding down. We're kind of getting close on time. An hour always goes by so fast. Doug, thank you so much for being here and talking with me here. I do have one more question that I hope you can leave our listeners with. And it's just, it's kind of a big one, but I like to ask everyone this when I get a chance to speak with artisans and musicians. Do you have any advice for anyone pursuing, you know, some of these creative fields, like poetry and music, and even people that are new to the Appalachian region that want to learn more about it? Do you have any advice for kind of promoting or preserving some of the history that's here? If you could leave our listeners today with that. And if you would like to read one final poem, that would be great.
Okay. Well, as far as preserving and getting in contact with our history and cultural past and present and future, I think, you know, having a hungry eye and a hungry ear is really important. Ask questions. Ask the people who you run into who are doing, who are making music, who are building instruments, who are cooking in the traditional way, or doing writing, painting, whatever, however they're responding and expressing their connection to this place. Ask questions. Most of the people that I've met are incredibly friendly and helpful. That's how I learned, is I just asked people who knew more, and that's how I got to know more. And there's a generosity in the arts community and the traditional life community that's just, it's just palpable generosity, and people really, really welcome people who are sincerely interested. And then there are a number of places that have programs. The Augusta Workshops, of course, and the Augusta Festival in Elkins, but also there's the Hindman Settlement School in Hindman, Kentucky, that has a wonderful summer this Appalachian Writers Week that I go to as often as I can, and where they sort of the best writers in the region come to teach and read and be together and share ideas. And then there are just many other opportunities, John C. Campbell Folk School, and there's just lots of places that you can, if you start looking around, you can get in contact with people who know about whatever it is you're interested in, and then just keep after it. And remember that, and maybe the most important thing is remember that these are durable traditions. So don't feel like they're these fragile things that you have to handle with kid gloves. And don't let that keep you from trying to make music or trying to make a quilt or build an instrument or whatever. Just try it and keep after it. Keep doing it if you love it and you're interested in it. Keep doing whatever it is until you get good enough that people start coming up to you and asking for your help and direction.
I love that advice.
Because none of it comes quick and easy, but it does come.
That's wonderful. And you're very inspiring. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. I'm glad we finally got a chance to work this out. Do you have another poem you'd like to read?
I do. I'll finish with one of the poems from the Guardian Project. And it's called Home Burial, a Love Poem. Please, don't allow any strangers to lie on this ridge or any backhoes dig into this ground. I need you to make a shovel-opened, shoulder-pried grave for me when I go. Box me, don't burn me. Store me away in a hillside I know like my bones. dig down to a clay floor so water won't get in easy. While I want to die quickly, I want my body to linger as long as it can, at least a century, between box and bare bones. There is no way you can bury me without entering the earth yourself. You need to know that worm's eye view. Feel the blade of the spade slicing through roots of unknowable plants. See the rectangle of trapped sky from the bottom of my grave. Make certain it's safe enough, deep enough, square enough to hold my eternity. Once I am packaged and lowered, the preacher has interned his boilerplate and you have heaped your paper plate with fried chicken and pie. Shovel me covered. After you do this, there is nothing I will not do for you. I believe in the body, not its resurrection.
All right, that just wrapped up our interview with Doug Van Gundy. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, you can catch Mountain Song and Story every Thursday at 4 o'clock, right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past programs if you visit the Mountain Song and Story program blog page on over at listenradiobristol.org. As always, I'll have the songs and materials and all the links from today's program up there. Special thanks goes out to Doug Van Gundy again for speaking with me and joining me for today's program. Again, if you want to learn more about some of the things we talked about during the show today, please go ahead and visit the Mountain Song and Story blog page for all of those resources. Thank you so much again for tuning in. I've got one more Carter Family song here for you today on this hour. Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? And I will see you next week.
And they lay me down to rest.